your family, your community, your country, your responsibility. Be the best citizen you can be. Find the Bill of Rights on leadersay.co.za.
Well, I know that it is 100% not the book show, but we are talking about a book, and we're talking about the ideas inside the book. And my guest in the studio is Ian Golden, and he is director of the 21st Century School at Oxford, and through the school's program of research, collaboration and education, he's powering new cross-disciplinary thinking about global problems from the near and the far future. But I just found this book, I haven't finished it, but I think it is such an interesting book. So if you are interested in the future of the world, how we need to direct ourselves in the future, if you're interested in some of the problems that we have, I think this is going to be a book that is going to interest you a great deal. And it's simply called Divided Nations: Why Global Governance is Failing and What We Can Do About It. And Ian, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Just tell me why you're in South Africa at the moment.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, Jenny.
Thanks.
I'm here for some meetings just yesterday and today, and go back to Oxford, unfortunately, tonight.
Well, I don't think going back to Oxford is unfortunate, because it's so beautiful and it's so stimulating. I used to live outside Oxford, and it's just the most beautiful city. It really is.
It is lovely. The weather's worse there in spring than it is here in autumn.
Oh, well.
And I miss Joburg, but yeah, it's a good place to live.
Tell us first of all about the Oxford Martin School in Oxford. Just tell us a little bit about that.
This is a start-up in Oxford. Oxford's a 900-year-old university, and we've been going 6 years. I'm the founding director of the school. And what we aim to do is bring great people together to tackle some of the world's toughest problems. We've got about 350 faculty now, researchers from across the university, something like 25 different disciplines, working in teams on issues ranging from new cures for cancer, climate change, financial crises, most of the big issues we're dealing with. And our idea is, by being innovative in the way we bring these people together and getting wonderful people, we can hopefully contribute to the solutions and transmit these into business and to governments around the world.
And how do you transmit it? Because here you've got this amazing think tank, and in essence, I think it's a think tank. And you've got these people from all these different disciplines, and these different disciplines bleed into one another. So they're not doing it in isolation. It's got to sort of bleed into the others. But how do you get it across to the rest of the world? I know that you've stood up recently and said, you know, Britain has got to, you know, cut back on this austerity thing because there are huge dangers there. But you don't often do that and make statements like that. How do you get your message across?
Well, all of the academics are really world leading in their own fields. And so they work, and we all work together, to communicate with the audiences that are relevant for the work. So ranging from pandemic management to financial management, whatever the issue is. Working with sort of the thought leaders around the world is one aspect. Another aspect is to give a lot of public talks to try and get the societies involved, because in the end, politicians, I think, need to respond to society's demands. And of course, we try and work with the media, we try and do publications, we try and get our ideas out in other ways. But it's a big battle, and clearly having great ideas is the beginning of it. Getting those ideas then translated into other agendas, I think, is very important. And we have to be quite humble in this as well, because clearly we're just one of the many, many places in the world working on these issues. We think we're the best at doing joined-up thinking on the future because of the breadth and depth, the people there. But we need, of course, to join up with others that are working on many of these areas around the world.
And your motivation initially, I mean, you've had fantastic experience, and of course you are South African by birth, and you were an advisor to Nelson Mandela, and so, you know, I mean, it's not as if, you know, you were here for 2 months and then you disappeared abroad, but you've got a solid history in South Africa and whatever. But the founding point of all of this, what was it?
Yeah, I'm very much South African, born in Pretoria, and it was a huge privilege and pleasure to be the chief executive of the DBSA and be part of Madiba's government at that time. The motivation behind the school is really because we feel that there's this humanity at the crossroads, really, at the moment. There are massive challenges out there. This could be our best century ever. It could be a century in which poverty and disease are eradicated, where we finally are able to share the incredible advances that humanity has achieved, not least over the last 20, 30 years, very broadly. Or it could be our worst century ever. There's really a whole multitude of new ways in which we could destroy the planet and ourselves. And, of course, there are great risks, systemic risks, growing inequality, and many other risks that need to be dealt with. And what the school aims to do is really address that. We believe that the outcome will depend on our ability to have new ideas and translate them into actions. So it's the propagation and development of these ideas which is really behind the school. We were very fortunate to get a very large gift from James Martin, which is why it's called the James Martin 21st Century School, the Oxford Martin School, to kickstart it. We've been fortunate in raising a lot more funding from a multitude of other sources, but it's really to pay people's salaries to enable them to come together in Oxford. And I think we're developing a critical mass, but clearly we're a startup and the jury's out as to whether we're going to have a long-lasting impact.
Well, some of the, as you write, some of the organizations that were formed in the last century, the United Nations, for instance, they haven't really managed to cope with globalization and the world as it is today, and we are hurtling forward in so many directions that you can't have these organizations where they take months to come to a decision, and by then the battle is over, the Holocaust has happened, and all of those things. So there are organizations that were founded that were maybe appropriate in their time, but they simply haven't kept up. So surely one of the things you're looking at is how to make these groupings relevant to the kind of world we're in and contributing, or else they're just going to atrophy, aren't they?
Yes, and I wrote Divided Nations, which is very much about this, because of the sense of frustration that actually we know what many of the solutions are to some of these greatest challenges, be they climate change, be they financial crises, many of the other issues. It's not really the lack of ideas, it's the lack of action, particularly political action, and also the recognition that action by any one country is not going to be enough to deal with global issues. And increasingly, issues are global because we're in this hyper-integrated, connected world where everything that we do affects others abroad, and similarly, they affect our futures. The financial crisis was a sort of graphic first representation of what I believe will be a series of crises in the 21st century where these things spill over borders and come from out of our societies. So we need more effective global governance. The system is totally unfit for 21st century purpose. Much of it was started after the Second World War in response to other crises, the Second World War, the Great Depression, the tragedies of that time. But unfortunately, these institutions have largely fossilized. They have very many well-meaning people in them. But the governments which run them, and in the end, all these international institutions are run by their shareholders, who the national governments, and particularly the powerful national governments, haven't allowed them to move with the times, have allowed them to be captured either by particular governments or particular issues. And so we have this incredible disconnect between the challenges of our time and the global institutions of our time. And they need radical reform. We need to have a different sort of global governance system. I'm a great believer in the need for global rules, global governance. I don't think we can manage the planet without that giving up of some sovereignty and having some global support for the decision making. But it's an urgent task. And we see in a whole series of areas, finance is obviously graphic, well-developed financial system, and many people say finance is the best of the global governance systems. Institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, the Bank for International Settlements, people might not like them, but they're well endowed, they have very many skilled people, and they have finance, and they have data. And yet these institutions and their national counterparts, the treasuries, the central banks, proved themselves in the financial crisis totally unfit for purpose. We've seen the collapse of the climate negotiations. We've seen the collapse of negotiations on cyber. We've seen orphan issues like migration, fester. So there's a whole series of issues that require much closer coordination. And what we're getting instead is actually a retreat. These organizations are getting weaker and are less empowered, partly because the old people that used to run the world, the US, Europe, Japan, are absorbed in their own crisis management, don't have the bandwidth, the appetite, financial or intellectual, to really reform these institutions. And the new leaders, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and others, have not yet been able to step up to the plate and really take these institutions and lead them. So in the sort of power vacuum, in a way, hand over from the West to the rest, and that makes it particularly dangerous as we enter this perfect storm of the coming decades, which really requires someone at the wheel. So we're in a global village, but there are no village elders is the basic problem.
Well, listen, we invite you obviously to call in and to talk about some of the issues that we're going to be dealing with. And I love this. If you remember a few weeks ago, we were talking about the world in the next 50 years, the way the population is going to peak at a certain time, then it'll start coming down if the forecasts are correct, the amount of food that is needed to produce to feed the billions of new human beings that are going to be born in this century, and talking about their health and all sorts of things. And I love this looking forward, and I love the sense of us trying to craft a new future for the world and for the people who live in it. So if you want to participate, please, the number to dial is 883-0702, and my guest in the studio is Ian Golden. He begins chapter one in his new book, Divided Nations. I wrote this book because I believe that increasingly globalization presents a paradox. It's been the most progressive force in history, but the most severe crises of the 21st century will arise due to the very success of globalization. And then he goes on to say, unless we're able to manage these threats, there's a real danger that globalization will have given birth to its downfall. So let's talk about health. And health, in a way, is being managed, it seems to me, globally. Smallpox, all but eradicated. Polio, all but eradicated. The world's attention now is focusing on malaria, a huge amount of work on AIDS. There seems to be a system where if there's an outbreak, we get World Health Organization people coming in and either limiting it or trying to go to the source. Tell me what's wrong with that. Is that working? Is that the way we should be working in the future?
I think health is an area where the glass is half full. There have been extraordinary successes, and you mentioned the eradication of smallpox, with people, mass brigades, going to every village and identified every individual in the world that had smallpox. Just an extraordinary achievement for the global health system. And hopefully we'll be achieving that on polio as well. And then there are much bigger challenges with malaria and in other areas. And things like river blindness have also been eradicated in West Africa. So there is enormous success. Unfortunately, the very positive aspects of globalization, and you read from my first few sentences, also are a source of great instability in health. And the two areas I just highlight, one is the new chronic diseases, so obesity, diabetes, and many others, which are afflicting many societies. But more significantly, a massive area around the potential pandemics, connectivity, living in close proximity, urbanization, and greater density of people. And they're now, you know, since we really started globalizing in the early 90s, about 2 billion more people in the planet, well over half urbanized, are the conditions which lead to the spreading of pandemics. Also, increased consumption of meat increases the risk of pandemics, because a lot of these pandemics start with animals and then move over to humans. The swine flu, which came out of Mexico City, was in something like 150 countries in 6 weeks. And we've done a mapping, our emergent infections and pandemics group, of the relationship of that to airline traffic. And it's exactly correlated with big hubs like Heathrow being the vectors and the spreaders globally of these pandemics. So anything that starts anywhere in the world now can actually be everywhere within 48 hours. Massive potential for the super spreading of bads in globalization as well as goods. And this is a very good example of the bads that can spread. The system of pandemic management is evolving. I believe that it needs to evolve much more rapidly. I believe that we need to use some of our new technologies like mobile phones to create sensor devices. I believe we need global SWAT teams that can very quickly be in a location and isolate it. The problem with a pandemic is once it gets out of its village and to an airport, you're finished, basically, in terms of the global spread. And I think we've just been incredibly lucky, and that's what most of the experts say, that the things that we've seen evolve over the last 50 years or so have had not had very high mortality rates. So, and the contagion levels have also been relatively low. We shouldn't be complacent. We shouldn't believe that our systems or our antibiotics, and there's a whole big issue, by the way, developing on antibiotic resistance, which is similarly one of these common goods. But we shouldn't believe that the past is an indicator of the future when it comes to pandemics. I believe that we need to redouble our efforts, become much more vigilant, and put in place systems which will be more effective. The scale at which pandemics killed in the past is something that we tend to forget. It's said that up to half of the English population died in the Black Plague, which was brought by a rat on a ship, also the early globalization. Up to 50 million people might have died in the Spanish flu, although there were no records and no mass hysteria then. It would be very, very different now. So I think we need to be much more vigilant about that. And I do think there are advances, but I think the World Health Organization and the national counterparts need to be given much more capacity.
When you talk about the 1918 flu epidemic, we, even today, are not quite totally sure why it was so incredibly lethal. Because, I mean, it certainly attacked in South Africa. It went straight to the gold mines. It went straight to the old compounds, and there it just decimated the population. And then it moved on to the more spacious areas, and it equally, it killed loads of people in spite of hygiene and whatever. Do you think that if something as virulent as that and as fast-spreading as that particular flu, do you think we would have difficulty in controlling, combating it in today's world?
Yes, I don't want to alarm your listeners. I don't see this as the biggest threat, but I think we would. And I think we need to understand that you can't isolate yourself. This is one of the many areas where national governments on their own will not be able to withstand the forces of globalization. This will be a global threat. Of course, what's different now to 1918 is not only that we'll know about it instantaneously, and we already know about this new potential arising in China, for example, from the internet, but we'll also react and we'll start getting hysterical. And there are big questions about then who has the drugs, whether you use them, the ethics around distribution, the logistics around distribution, and so on. So that's very, very important. The movie Contagion, which has recently come out, is actually, I think, and according to our scientists, is a very accurate rendition of the sort of thing that could happen.
There's a common thread in your book, and that is when you have, as we have, hundreds of different countries in the world, that we can no longer count on our borders. Something that happens in South Africa, whether it is the start of a pandemic or whatever, or a financial crisis within South Africa, let's say a housing crisis, it takes practically seconds or the push of a button before it somehow or other manages to infect the rest of the world. There is no such thing, actually, as a border left in today's world, is there?
Well, this is the challenge that I address not only in this book, but I'm doing a series of books on globalization. So my previous book on making globalization work for development and poverty reduction, and also my work on finance, on migration and other areas are all about this. There are many things that national governments can do in an age of hyperconnectivity and globalization. So in the end, I believe that we should manage at as local a level things that we can control our futures on. But in terms of these big global shifting sorts of phenomena, it is the case that we're going to have to be much more coordinated. Now, the sorts of investment that a country makes, whether it's in education and skills, basic health systems, infrastructure systems, telecommunication systems, all of these things really matter. And the effectiveness of governments, the effectiveness of regulation, of competition policy, things like that really matter in the ability of countries to be resilient and to respond on their own terms. It's countries that are most vulnerable and most unthinking about these connections that are going to find themselves most affected. So I think there's a lot that citizens can do, there's a lot that countries can do, but in the end, we have to be less divided as nations and more joined up to ensure that these global institutions, whether it's about the oceans, the atmosphere, the financial system, the pandemic system, and other systems, that we're more joined up. We can do it in some areas. So things like, for example, the International Postal Union and International Air Traffic Control work beautifully, despite massive political changes, the redefinition of boundaries, technological changes, etc. We agree to abide by those sorts of rules because it doesn't make sense for any one nation to try it differently, to fly on the other side, as it were, of the airwaves. But it is the case that when we, in some other areas, we don't want to give up any sovereignty at all, and there will be some sacrifice involved. I see this very much a bit like football. You know, whether you Suarez at the top of the first division earning more money than all the players, most probably in a fourth division team put together, when the ref shows a red card, you have to abide by the same rules, otherwise you don't have a common playing field. Unfortunately, in governance, governments decide what they want to do, when they're going to do it, and the big and powerful governments are particularly bad at not playing by global rules and trying to run these global institutions as if they were their own.
Chatting to Ian Golden, the title of his latest book is Divided Nations, Why Global Governance is Failing and What We Can Do About It. So it's not doom and gloom. There are situations that are highlighted. What can we do about it? And this is where this amazing, almost 400-strong think tank comes into its own. John.
John, is this? Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
Good afternoon to you, and Ian. First of all, I'd like to say I'm delighted to find that the James Martin Institute is growing. His book, about 5 years ago.
Ian, just move around because you're breaking up.
Sorry.
John.
Is it John? I beg your pardon. Yes. Move around.
Okay, can you hear me?
No. We're going to phone you back, John, okay? We're going to try and get you on a landline, see if we can. So, Derek in Monument Park. Hi there, Derek.
Hello, Jenny, and good afternoon to your guest. Mm. One burning question. Where did you go to school? Where was this flame started that burned so brightly?
Pretoria Boys High.
What a quest.
Some other great Pretoria Boys High alumni like Elon Musk.
Ian, it's so nice to hear that. Yes, I am an old boy, and I'm an old boy. I'm 77. Mm. And to hear your enthusiasm, to hear your work, it's beautiful.
Thank you very much.
That is really, really nice of you. Derek in Monument Park. Derek, thanks very much indeed. And John, hopefully coming on the line again. And keep the calls coming, 883-0702. And John, sorry about that. I hope this line is better.
Yes, too. I was just saying I'm delighted to hear that the James Martin Institute has been growing. I read his book, The Meaning of the 21st Century, a couple of years ago. And I'm delighted to, by chance, just switch on and listen to you this afternoon. Now, I'd like to ask two questions of Ian. First of all, is Professor Jeffrey Sachs, this would be down his street, is he participating? And secondly, as you know, he was in charge under Ban Ki-moon and Kofi Annan of the Millennium Development Goals, which turned out to be a fairly effective way. And basically, he argues passing resolutions at the UN doesn't get you that far. But if you can get goals, they did on the Millennium Development Goals, they've now set a new set of goals, and that is the Sustainable Development Goals, which they're busy drawing up with countries around the world and with no doubt groups like yourselves, and seems to be a much more effective way of getting at least some action from around the world, from civic society as well as governments and the press and what have you.
Okay. Right, Ian.
Thanks very much, John. The Oxford Martin School is very much inspired by the sorts of things that Jim Martin talks about in The Meaning of the 21st Century, but obviously as an academic institution with independent people, we don't agree with him on everything, but we're certainly inspired by his vision. Jeff Sachs and I speak a lot, so he runs the Earth Institute at Columbia University. What we've done is we've brought various groups from one place to the other. I've taken a team to Columbia and he's brought a team to Oxford. They mainly cover the areas of poverty reduction and the environment. So there's a whole series of areas that we cover that they don't work on in the Earth Institute. But we do collaborate with them as we do with others that are sort of trying to address global challenges. The MDGs, you're absolutely right. Jeff was very involved in advising the Secretary General of the UN on those. I was privileged to be at Monterey and in the very much in the kitchen when I was head of development policy at the World Bank and vice president there in work on the MDGs. And I think you're absolutely right that having these targets and moving from general statements to goalposts that everyone signs up to, achievable goalposts and monitoring and evaluation along the way on the different dimensions of progress was absolutely vital, and massive progress was made, not least in the coordination of aid around that. Moving to the next agenda after 2015 is what everyone is focused on now in that area, and I think you're absolutely right. That needs to include notions of sustainability and the environment.
John, thanks very much indeed for your question. More questions coming up after this. Well, let's go to Ingrid in Houghton, and thanks for holding on, Ingrid.
No problem. I want to congratulate Mr. Golden on the work he's doing. And I'd like to ask him, is any work being done on consciousness and communication? Because I saw recently in the paper a little snippet saying that Peter Gabriel and a professor at MIT are looking at interspecies communication with animals using computers.
That's a fascinating question. We're working in a number of areas, and I think this is all just really at the very, very beginning. One area that we have a very strong team on is neuroscience, who are trying to understand the brain, which is obviously still even more complicated than the universe to understand. And I think we're making some progress. We're beginning to understand why flies turn right and left, and why, for example, they have sex when they do. So this is the beginning of a very long journey towards understanding how we form ideas and decisions. We're also beginning to benefit greatly from magnetic resonance. So as you know, the power of this is doubling every year, with computer capacity doubling every year, Moore's Law, which means that we're beginning to be able to see what goes on and off in the brain when certain things are happening. And that's massive in terms of the potential progress. So it also raises very big questions. For example, when people are supposedly brain dead, if you start seeing things happening, it raises questions about the boundaries between life and death. So this is very much the early days in terms of the neuroscience of consciousness. I believe we will be moving towards, as Peter is exploring, understanding animal communication, animal behavior. And one of the things I've said is I think our views on eating animals will be very different in 20 or 30 years' time, because I think we'll understand some of the emotions and communication that they might, or certain types. I don't think this will apply to some of the smaller species, perhaps, but certain types of animals experience, and that might change our views about, for example, eating them or how we cage them and other things. So I think this is going to be one of the really exciting areas of development.
Ingrid, thanks very much indeed for your call. Right, let's go on now and talk about, I mean, I've scribbled down health, I've scribbled down migration, but you were just talking about one of the areas where there has to be some kind of agreement in the world, and it's one of the highlights, one of the five highlights in terms of globalization that we have to address in the next century. I'm talking about climate change. And for me, it's just been lamentable. We know that there's such a thing as climate change. We can see it around us, and in parts of the world you can actually feel it, and the uncertainty of the weather, so many other things. And yet it seems that governments are absolutely intransigent. The US, I think, is appalling when it comes to signing treaties and keeping to the treaties. Or are we doing the wrong thing?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Jenny. Just on the five examples I give in the book of areas we absolutely have to make progress, those are examples. We actually have to make progress on many more than five issues. I don't, for example, talk about the oceans in the book and other areas which we have to make progress on. But climate change is certainly an area where the facts are all there. There's not a scientist I've spoken to that's not absolutely convinced. And certainly all the scientists, and we have many, many in the Oxford Mind School, we've got over 50 scientists working on climate change. But all they and their colleagues around the world believe it's happening. There's huge uncertainty as to the implications, what it'll mean for rainfall or for wind, for temperature, etc., in any one locality, which makes it very difficult to make decisions about whether you build an irrigation system, whether you build higher defenses, etc. But one thing is clear is that it's likely to lead to, for example, oceans rising, mass variation, so much more instability. And we know that poor people particularly suffer most. So this is likely to exacerbate inequality and poverty. And so we really should do something urgently at a mass global scale. I think there are two things which are puzzling. One is in other areas of our life when there's uncertainty. So we don't know whether our houses are going to burn down or whether we're going to have an accident in our cars. But we wear a safety belt, we take precautions in our homes, we get insurance. We prepare to allocate a bit of resource to stop uncertain things happen. The world doesn't seem prepared to do that. Even for the skeptics, I say, even if you think there's only a 5% chance the scientists might be right, why don't you act as if that risk could well materialize and be prepared to do something about it? So that's a big puzzle. Why don't people that think it's uncertain act? And then, of course, why don't governments act? The main reason, and we see this as a big challenge in South Africa, is for the big problem has been created by the rich countries. Over the last 200 years, they've become rich because of the carbon they've emitted, the energy systems that they have in their economies. And that's a long historical stock of carbon in the atmosphere. The flow, the biggest flow, is now from developing countries. Over half the carbon going up into the atmosphere is now from developing countries. And for ethical, for political and economic reasons, poverty reduction reasons, we can't stop that. South Africa can't say we're not going to electrify because we don't want climate change, indeed, for example. And this is happening in India, it's happening in China, it's happening around the world. So we have to push for renewables, we have to push for other systems, we have to embed the new technologies very rapidly. But the rich countries have to do more than developing countries because they're the cause of the stock of problem in the atmosphere. And they have got rich on the basis of this. They aren't prepared to do it. The US is not prepared to do it. Europe's not prepared to do it unless the US does it, because they don't want their energy prices to be higher than in US and black, and their competitiveness will be eroded. So we're in this terrible situation. I believe that like-minded countries should begin to move. I believe that we as individuals should move. We should change our own personal behavior, and that we should create citizens movements, we should create governments. And this is happening, for example, amongst big cities. So cities are forming an alliance around climate change. Some states like California and others in the US are adopting policies. But what we've got to be careful in this, we don't just export the problem. So you let the dirty things be produced in elsewhere and you import them from those places. And what's important is that we also in our consumer behavior make sure that doesn't happen. But I think the time has really come that citizens have to demand much more of their governments in this. Countries are divided, and they're divided because we let them be divided. We need to ensure that they put this as a high priority, and I absolutely believe it's extremely urgent. The problem is that there's a few urgent problems out there. Finance is an urgent problem, and I talk about some others. We also need to tell our governments, you can juggle more than one ball at a time. You need to be more active on multiple stages and also get into constituency politics. So you take a lead on one issue, let some other country take a lead for you. And what I believe in climate, for example, is we don't need all 202 countries in the world to form a climate agreement. I think that's impossible. They'll never agree. And I'm not even absolutely convinced we have to wait until the US comes to the table. If a critical mass of polluters can get together with a critical mass of countries most affected, and Bangladesh is a good example because 30 million people in Bangladesh will be underwater when the oceans rise by only 2 meters, as they're likely to do in the next 50 to 100 years, I believe that we should sort of sign up to those agreements. So we can't allow the fact that, in this case, the US is not prepared to sign a global agreement to mean that all the rest of us don't do anything.
All right, well, I mean, that is absolutely huge. What do you call a critical mass?
Well, I think in an area like climate, and very much depends on the issue, the interesting thing about carbon emissions, and obviously there are other greenhouse gases too, is that a very small number of countries, about 10 countries, account for something like 75 to 80% of the emissions. Mm. China, India, the US, European group, are over half together of them. You add Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa, which is one of the biggest emitters in the Southern Hemisphere, and you begin to get critical mass of emitters. Then you need some critical mass of affected, and obviously many countries like South Africa, like China, are going to be dramatically affected both ways. So I think one can do it, but I think one needs to apply the sort of 80-20 rule. Find the 20% that are going to make 80% of the difference and start there.
All right, well, we're talking about a book called Divided Nations, Why Global Governance is Failing and What We Can Do About It. The book is written by Ian Golden. He's in the studio with me. If you want to give us a call, the number to dial is 883-0702, but you can SMS me as well, 31702, and standard SMS rates apply. Well, we're sharing our views and we're chatting to Ian Golden, and I'll give you all of the details of the book a little bit later on. One of the issues that you speak about that is very important in South Africa is migration. And whether it's emigration or immigration, it makes no difference. But in South Africa's case, the number of people who come into South Africa, many of them illegally, many of them living in appalling conditions in the middle of town, in the middle of Joburg, and buildings that can't be rescued and things like that. And there is a huge amount of hostility towards the newcomers to this country. And one of the reasons South Africa's worked, I think, is because new people have come and brought their talents and brought their energies to this country. How do we resolve this migration problem? Because there is a migration problem.
Yes, migration is one of the most misunderstood of the global flows. Of course, it's also the oldest of the global flows. We wouldn't exist as Homo sapiens as that we know today if we hadn't migrated around Africa, around the world, and then now reuniting, as has been said, the scatterlings coming together around the world. And it's the cause of all the major leaps forwards of civilizations. So it's deep. It's the cause of us being special, as it were, as a species, is the fact that we were able to adapt and move around the world and then come together and learn from each other very rapidly. And all the big advances of civilization over time have been when people have come together, whether it was when East and West met about 1,000 years ago, when Islamic and Christian civilizations discovered all sorts of things that each other had been developing. And also in many other ways. And we've seen this in South Africa with sanctions and apartheid and the opening up of South Africa. The remarkable changes that have come from being part of the world and connecting. And part of that is, as you open your borders, more people move as well, both ways. So it's absolutely central. I wrote my book, Exceptional People, How Migration Shaped Our World and Will Define Our Future, because I wanted to place this in a longer-term perspective and try and place our immediate concerns in the context of where do we want to be as a society, whether it's South Africa or in Britain or the US, wherever it is, where do we want to be in 10, 20, 30 years' time? And how do we see ourselves as individuals and how do we see the competitiveness of our country and jobs in our country developing? There's enormous myths around migration. There's very little data. So, for example, data on whether migrants lower or raise wages, whether they take jobs or contribute jobs, whether they bring innovation or take innovation. Basic questions like that are not known in terms of the answers. But all the evidence that I've seen, and I think I've looked at virtually everything that's out there, both for South Africa and for the rest of the world, is that most of the myths are exactly that. They're myths. So migrants create net jobs, they bring investment net, they contribute more to the fiscus than they take out, and as a source of dynamism in society, they an enormous opportunity. The big questions around migration tend to be around the ability of societies in the short term to manage cultural differences, fears, anxiety, issues like housing, education, strain on infrastructure, strain on other resources. That's where the crunch tends to be. And in a way, it's a bit like the trade debates. The costs tend to be very local and very short-term, and the benefits tend to be diffuse and more medium-term. And so the big challenge, not least for a city like Johannesburg, is, okay, so we understand that migrants might benefit South Africa in the longer term. We understand why they're here, many of them escaping terrible situations like in Zimbabwe, for example. And we're sympathetic to that, but we don't want to have our education systems or our health systems, et cetera, overrun. We don't want them to take our jobs. And I think those are very valid concerns, and one can see why people get so anxious about them. I think there's a massive national responsibility to have grown-up debates about these things, to talk about them, and to be able to both understand what's happening, but also set aside the resources nationally, the budgetary resources, the housing resources, and the investments in education and other areas. If we want people to be here, we need to give them rights and responsibilities like citizens. Responsibilities mean they have to pay tax. They have to be law-abiding. We want to know who they are, so we want to document them.
We want to know where they are.
And we want to know where they are. So documentation is a very important dimension. Rights is we want to treat them fairly. They need recourse to law. They need to be treated as human beings. They need to have pensions that are portable, for example. They need to have some other rights as well, be part of the system. Of course, when they document it, it also means they won't undercut through being undocumented on a building site or other site by getting minimum wages, etc. We want them to also abide by the rules, but it's also an onus on employers. So I believe that's the sort of deal that societies should be striking. What we see in the US is quite remarkable now, given also how quickly it's happened. They're talking about legalizing 11 million
yes.
undocumented workers.
Yes.
And from the right to the left in the US, there's now finally a recognition that this won't create more problems, that it's going to be incredibly beneficial to the U.S. And I've even seen some estimates, not least those coming from right-wing think tanks, that this might add 0.5% of U.S. GDP and jobs. So the debate is shifting based on evidence, but that is, I think, lacking in many areas. So we need to think this through much more carefully, but I don't think the response is to slam our doors.
Interesting, because I think in Europe, with aging populations in Europe, they actually, I think you wrote about this, they're actually going to need younger people coming in. And where do the younger people come from? Well, they come from countries that actually need to move a little bit, like Africa, for instance, or, you know. And I just found that very, very interesting, because the world is changing literally as we're standing on it.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, the OECD estimate is that its workforce will reduce from about 800 million to 600 million over the next 35 years or so. And that's a dramatic decline in fertility and higher dependency ratios as people get older. Unfortunately, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia are not going to be cured in the short term. So very large number of highly dependent people. Migrants are going to be a great part of the solution, as many societies are already recognizing.
Look, it's been a fascinating discussion. It really and truly is. I'd love you to stay a bit longer, but it can't be. But let me give the details of Ian's book, and I'm sure it's whetted your appetite to do a little bit more reading. Divided Nations, Why Global Governance is Failing and What We Can Do About It. And it's Oxford University Press. It's R195 approximately. It's not in every single bookstore. You might just have to order it, and it usually takes anything between a week to 6 weeks in South Africa for you to get your book. But I would go and order it immediately. R195, Oxford University Press.